Support for this On the Media podcast comes from Audible.com, provider of digital audiobooks and more, across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. More at audiblepodcast.com/onthemedia.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And here's Michelle Bachman.
And it started in Iowa. You've done it, Iowa. Thank you.
With last week's Iowa straw poll, an event of no historical significance, the presidential campaign of 2012 is well underway. The straw poll drew flocks of reporters, mostly because, like Everest, it was there. Pity the poor campaign reporter, dogging the steps of scripted politicians, desperate for that rare unscripted moment, that moment known as the gaffe. Think John McCain not knowing how many houses he owned. Some gaffes get repeated over and over again in the press and the blogosphere. They stick to candidates like tar, while others leave no trace. Why? The American Prospect's Paul Waldman has a theory. He says reporters cover the gaffes that reinforce the conclusions they've already made about a candidate.
Candidates end up getting defined by their most prominent character flaw, and the gaffe is one of the primary ways that reporters communicate that to us, essentially by saying, see, this thing that I've been thinking about this guy all the time, it's true, and here's the evidence.
Basically, you're saying reporters are on Freudian slip patrol.
To a great extent, they are. And now we have this entire apparatus to encourage them in that. So every candidate is being followed around by people who are hired by their opponents' campaigns or by the other party with cameras, whose job essentially is to try to find that gaffe, to be there when it happens.
Can we quickly run through some of the current contenders and their gaffes, beginning with the winner of the Iowa straw poll, Michelle Bachman? Here, she's talking about channeling the spirit of a guy from her hometown.
Well, what I want them to know is, just like John Wayne was from Waterloo, Iowa, that's the kind of spirit that I have, too.
The person who was from Waterloo wasn't John Wayne, but John Wayne Gacy, the serial killer. Now, what's interesting about this is that's the kind of mistake we all make at some point. You know, we hear something, we repeat it, we don't remember it quite the right way. But because it's Bachman and people tend to think of her as kind of a lightweight, then therefore that becomes evidence that she really is not all that bright. And of course, the fact that it's kind of amusing helps that, too.
Let's listen to the gaffe of a candidate who is generally regarded as extremely bright.
Over the last 15 months, we've traveled to every corner of the United States. I've now been in 57 states. I think one left to go.
What he meant there was that he had competed in 57 contests, including in some territories like Guam and Puerto Rico that are not states. Conservatives actually have tried to get reporters to repeat that 57 states comment, but nobody really believes that Barack Obama doesn't know how many states there are, and so it doesn't stick.
We've been talking about factual mistakes, absolute gaffes. But in your article for The Washington Post, you make reference to a lot of other remarks that candidates have made, which to me don't seem like gaffes. For instance, Republican Mitt Romney called corporations people. You call that a gaffe. I call that simply a comment that reveals his view.
We have to make sure that the promises we make in Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare are promises we can keep. And there are various ways of doing that. One is we could raise taxes on people. That's not the way. Corporations are people, my friend. We can raise taxes on. Of course they are. Everything corporations earn ultimately goes to people. So where do you think it goes?
This is the kind of gaffe where, when you understand it in context, if he had a chance to explain it, you might disagree with it, but it would be something reasonable. What Romney was trying to say is that if you raise taxes on corporations, ultimately that will come out of the pockets of shareholders or other sorts of human beings. When you take it out of context, it enables people who were opposed to him to say, aha, look, this has stripped away the veneer. See, there's an assumption that all of campaigning is theater. And what the gaffe is supposed to do is to strip away that veneer and show us the real person. And that's why they'll get repeated over and over, especially by partisans on the other side, to say that all those other things that he said, that was just him trying to fool us. When he kind of slipped, that's when the mask came off and he showed us who he really is.
Well, let me apply this idea to Minnesota Republican Tim Pawlenty, who ended his campaign after the straw poll. On Fox News Sunday, he used the word Obamacare to describe Mitt Romney's health program in Massachusetts. It was the intentional coining of a word for political purposes. Later, he was backed into a corner because he didn't want to invoke the word again.
Your rival is standing right there. If it was Obamacare on Fox News Sunday, why is it not Obamacare standing here with the governor right there?
President Obama is the person who I quoted in saying he looked to Massachusetts for designing his program. He's the one who said it's a blueprint and that he merged the two programs. And so using the term Obamacare was a reflection of the president's comments that he designed Obamacare on the Massachusetts health care plan.
His decision not to have that argument with Mitt Romney on that stage, does that reveal what would actually be a weakness as a president? Two candidates could make the exact same statement, and reporters would make an entirely different set of conclusions about what was behind it based on the character flaw that they had already identified as that person's most important flaw.
Ron Paul, he is so widely ignored, despite his second place finish in the straw poll, that even his gaffes, such as they are never noted.
You can make an argument that he's not too different from someone like, say, Michelle Bachmann. I mean, he's someone who has a small but fervent group of supporters. He's a member of the House who has never passed any kind of important legislation, just as she hasn't. He would probably say, if you put me on the cover of Newsweek and you put me on Meet the Press and you did profiles of me on the front page of the New York Times, then I'd be getting more support, too. And he'd probably be right about that. But reporters already hold him in such contempt that nothing that he says will be particularly surprising to them and make them want to talk about it.
Paul, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Paul Waldman is a contributing editor at the American Prospect.
The gaffe tracking enterprise that Paul Waldman mentioned a minute ago has become industrial in scale, thanks to groups like American Bridge 21st Century, a progressive so-called super PAC that deploys trackers with video cameras to primary states to capture every word uttered by a Republican candidate. After all, a really serious gaffe can kill an election run. Consider the mother of all gaffes, Senator George Allen's macaca moment in 2006. The Virginia Republican noticed one of his opponent's trackers at a campaign event and proceeded to mock him with an obscure racial epithet.
This fella here over here with the yellow shirt, macaca, or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following.
In that moment, Allen's race for re-election and his hopes for the presidency were over. Rodel Molyneux, president of American Bridge 21st Century, says that the moment was a game changer for real-time gaffe tracking.
It was truly one of the biggest unforced errors in the history of politics, what happened with George Allen. You know, as far as some of the candidates that we're tracking, you know, listen, we're not tricking anybody. People say stupid things, and we're not forcing anyone to say the things that they are saying, but we are there to observe it and record it and to make sure that voters know just what are on the minds of some of these candidates. We're not editing video. This is going to be extremely transparent.
One right-wing video assassin, James O'Keefe, has artfully edited video material to, in some cases, grotesquely misrepresent what took place. Mm-hmm. Do you swear to me at this moment, hand on the Bible, that you will not alter context, meaning in any way for the political advantage? I mean, will you sign that oath?
I do. I will definitely sign that oath. The day that we go down any sort of path like that is the day that you go from being what we aspire to be, which is a respected political organization, to being Andrew Breitbart or James O'Keefe or TMZ or a tabloid. The work that we're doing in showing voters who these Republican candidates are, to us it's really meaningful, and we would never do anything to jeopardize that.
Okay, as long as you're in an oath-signing frame of mind, will you also agree here and now not to take an innocent, could happen to anyone mistake, a slip of the tongue, and portray it as somehow a smoking gun. I mean, one candidate, for example, confused Iran and Iraq, which could kind of happen to anybody. How bloodthirsty will you be?
I'm not sure if the candidate you're talking about is Tim Pawlenty, and I hate to kick a candidate when he's down and out, but if it is Tim Pawlenty, American Bridge actually did catch Tim Pawlenty confusing Iraq and Iran. But it wasn't a simple mistake. A reporter actually asked him a question. This is where the benefit of being able to see the video from start to finish helps put things in context. Now, granted, there are a couple of things. One, he was at the Cato Institute, which is a think tank here in Washington, D.C., giving a speech on foreign policy. That's the first thing. Two, he's running to be the leader of the free world. And three, the reporter asked him about Iran. So Tim Pawlenty talked for about a minute and a half about Iraq. And the reporter was patient and then finally interrupted him and said, no, 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 I'm asking you about Iran. And Tim Pawlenty said, yes, I know. And then continued to speak for another minute on Iraq. I don't consider something like that bloodthirsty, and I don't necessarily think that was unfair either.
Inevitably, Republican activists will be doing approximately the same thing with Democratic candidates and with the president. Are you ready for that?
Of course. The tracking and the research, it's part of politics today. I'd like to think that our organization can and will do it better than anyone else in the most comprehensive way so that we have video archives and footage of these candidates all the way through the general election. And the other thing, too, is this isn't just a 2012 project for us. This will be a permanent piece of Democratic infrastructure. And some of these candidates run again and again and again. And one of the things that they hope and pray are that people, the press, voters, forget some of their more inartful comments. So these archives of video and of research will live and breathe for some years to come.
Rodel Molyneux is president of American Bridge 21st Century, a super PAC that describes itself as a progressive research and communications organization committed to holding Republicans accountable for their words and actions and helping you ascertain when Republican candidates are pretending to be something they're not. Your business card must be the size of a sandwich board. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, Amazon's ambitions in the book industry. Threat or menace?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And now we're going to talk about a collision of new technology and old, by which I mean Amazon and the rest of the book industry. The company's maintained a publishing arm for the past 2 years, but it's really ramped up this summer. This week, the company announced that it had signed best-selling self-help author Timothy Ferris to its publishing division. And now most industry watchers expect more big-name authors to follow Ferris to Amazon. We asked Michael Schatzkin, who heads the Idealogical Company, a publishing industry consulting firm, whether traditional publishers should fear the 900-pound gorilla that is entering their midst.
The most important thing that publishers have done historically is going to be relegated to a place of much less importance. What we're seeing with Amazon is a sign of that.
So the folks at Random House should be shaking in their boots?
I think the folks at Random House, Simon & Schuster, Macmillan, HarperCollins, those publishers, I don't know if they're shaking in their boots, but they're certainly aware that the ground is shifting dramatically underneath them.
So talk about Amazon entering the publishing biz in this context. What's it got going for it, and does it have anything going against it?
Yes, it does have some things going against it. What it has going for it is direct customer contact to the millions and millions and millions of people that buy directly at Amazon.com. What Amazon's weakness is they don't have the customers that Barnes & Noble has, and they don't have the ability to put books into stores and on shelves. So the good news for Amazon is that what they're weak at is getting smaller, and what they're strong at is getting bigger. But we're still in a time when selling books in stores is important.
Why can't an Amazon imprint right now send a salesperson to Barnes & Noble and get the books into stores?
Well, the first problem is Barnes & Noble, because Amazon's desire in signing up authors directly is to monopolize the e-books for the Kindle platform. And Barnes & Noble made very clear earlier this week that the only way that they would consider buying an Amazon book to put on their shelves would be if Amazon also made that book available for them to sell as an e-book through their Nook platform. Amazon has never made any Sherman statement about what they would or wouldn't do.
Did you say a Sherman statement?
Yeah, that's when Sherman said in the 1880s that he would absolutely not run for president.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I mean as a defining, clear, unambiguous statement. They have not made a defining, clear, unambiguous statement that they will only sign up books for the Kindle platform and won't allow them outside. But I am not aware of any case in which Amazon's done that. So Barnes & Noble has said, yeah, well, we might stock your books, but only if you're going to make the books available through the Nook platform. And I don't think it's Amazon's intention to make the books available through the Nook platform. So scratch Barnes & Noble. The independent stores, who are also angry at Amazon, I mean, because among other things, we have a battle going on about sales taxes, and all the independent stores are paying sales taxes, and Amazon avoids sales taxes. Also, the independent stores are using Google eBooks. And of course, Amazon, if they're monopolizing for the Kindle, aren't going to make their eBooks available through Google eBooks. So the independent stores don't want to stock anything from Amazon. And that leaves you with the mass merchants, Walmart, Target, Kmart, stores like that. They ain't Amazon's best friend either. They're competing with Amazon as well. And those stores don't stock a lot of titles. So whether any particular Amazon title would make the cut would be an open question. Not all the Random House and Macmillan books make the cut.
For this story, we asked Amazon to furnish somebody to interview. They wouldn't do it. Why do you think they're holding their cards so close to the chest?
I think it's really the software business mentality versus the book business mentality. Amazon and Apple, and I must say, much less so Google, but Amazon and Apple reveal what they want to reveal when they decide that it's time to reveal it. That is their corporate style. I don't think it's likely to change anytime soon, and it certainly is frustrating for those of us who are in the publishing business and are really used to a lot of conversation about what we're doing from all sides of the value chain.
Speaking of Apple, there's this price-fixing accusation floating around. Could you summarize what that is and how it fits into this question of publishing in the future?
Well, it's not simple. The way books are sold is that the publisher actually sells the book to a store. The store has the right to return it. And then the store, having bought the book from the publisher, can set the price anywhere it wants to the consumer. And that's the way the ebook business works. So the publisher would say, this ebook is $30. I'm going to sell it to you for $15. It's up to the store to decide what they want to charge. Then Amazon decided, well, when they bought the book for $15, I think we'll charge $10. And the reason that they did that is they were trying to get people to buy Kindles, because once they bought Kindles, they would be locked into buying their books from Amazon. Publishers had two problems with this. One is that they could see Amazon moving to a monopoly on ebooks. But the other one is that they were undercutting the value of the print book, right? The $30 book was now being sold for $10 as an ebook. Publishers were upset with this because it made the migration from print to electronic, from store to online, move faster, which undercut their power. So in January 2010, Apple came on the scene and said, we're going to open a bookstore, but the way we want to work is what we call agency. You're not going to sell us the book. You're going to sell the customer the book. And we're just going to broker the relationship between you and the customer. You're going to set the price. But you got to set the same price everywhere. We can't have you setting a price for us and then have somebody else selling it for less. That was called agency. Five of the six major publishers immediately signed up for agency. And Amazon, after making a brief attempt to stop agency and threatened to boycott those books, withdrew that idea, agreed to agency, and agreed to a plan by which the price was set by the publishers. So the accusation, initially launched by a law firm in Seattle, I don't know if that's a coincidence or not, but a law firm in Seattle sued Apple and those five publishers saying you're fixing prices and alleging collusion.
But Mike, correct me here, but if a bunch of publishers get together with a bunch of vendors and they agree to set a price floor that the vendors cannot adjust, that sounds to me like the definition of fixing a price.
The person who's selling the product fixes the price.
They can't fix the price for Barnes & Noble then.
No, Barnes & Noble isn't selling the product. The publisher is. The publisher is accepting the sales tax liability. The publisher is accepting all the responsibility of the end seller. And therefore, the publisher is setting the price for that book, not for anybody else's book, just for their own book. And they're saying that that price will be the same at all points of purchase and that retailers have to compete on something other than price. I don't know the law. It may be price fixing. But I know the commercial impact, and the commercial impact is that Amazon was on its way to a monopoly. And because of the agency pricing scheme, we now have a healthy Barnes & Noble ebook business. We have Google and Kobo and Apple. We have a multi-retailer ebook business, and Amazon's ebook monopoly is nothing like what it looked like it was going to be 2 or 3 years ago, which I think is good for the industry and ultimately good for the consumer.
Mike, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Mike Schatzkin is the CEO of The Ideological Company.
Amazon publishing could be the answer to some authors' prayers. Take, for example, Deborah Reed. Today, she's the author both of the best-selling thriller A Small Fortune, which she wrote under the pen name Audrey Braun, and the forthcoming literary novel Carry Yourself Back to Me. Both are published by Amazon. But a year ago, when she was pitching Carry Yourself Back to Me to traditional publishers, she was collecting rejection slips. Sensing that her agent was about to give up, Reed took matters into her own hands.
And so I went behind her back and I entered it into the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award contest. And I didn't win that contest, but Amazon Publishing's editors had access to the manuscripts. And they pulled Carry Yourself Back to Me out of the pile, and the editor contacted me about the possibility of publishing it.
Meanwhile, you and your husband had a funny dinner conversation that turned into a different project.
I had read an article in the New York Times about genre books weathering the recession pretty well. And so as a joke, my husband and I came up with this genre book, a mystery thriller. We just batted it back and forth over dinner one night, came up with this entire story. And it was just a joke. And the next day, though, I couldn't get the scenes out of my head. And so I put some down and just kept writing and writing. And within 4 months, I had this entire manuscript.
And you go to traditional publishers with that. What did they say to you?
All of them rejected it. One of them said that she read it cover to cover, couldn't put it down, but it was too much like one of the best-selling authors on their list, and she couldn't have us both competing for the same shelf space at Barnes & Noble. I ended up self-publishing A Small Fortune under a pen name of Audrey Braun as an ebook on Amazon's website, as well as a publish-on-demand paperback. And the book started selling like crazy as an ebook.
Now let's carry ourselves back to Carry Yourself Back to Me. You get an email from an editor at Amazon Encore, one of its publishing imprints, and he says, "I'm very impressed with your writing. Let's talk about publishing." And you said to him, "Well, that's great. Oh, and by the way,
I'm also Audrey Braun, who's written A Small Fortune, which is selling really well right now on Amazon." This was over email, and he immediately emailed back and said, I'm absolutely stunned because I have Audrey's book on my Kindle and was intending to get in touch with Audrey also about a book contract. So,
so next thing you know, you have a 3-book deal among Amazon, you, and Audrey, who is also you.
That's correct. That's correct.
Sales for A Small Fortune
have been phenomenal. Give me the numbers.
It came in on the very first day, A Small Fortune hit the top 10 in ebooks, and it's remained in the top 20 in fiction, genre fiction, and mystery thrillers.
Some of this you can attribute to the quality of the manuscript, but there's a whole lot of other stuff going on. What's the other stuff that's going on? What has Amazon done for you?
They have the advantage of all of that advertising, real estate, online. They have the advantage of being in touch with all of their customers who have purchased mystery books before or other books that might be similar to mine. They have such an advantage when it comes to contacting readers, basically one-on-one. I'm an Amazon customer, and I actually received an email about new mystery books coming out, and lo and behold, there was my own book in the email. So it's that sort of thing that does give them an edge.
You got spammed with an ad for you.
For myself, yeah. And, you know, they used my book in a Kindle ad on the front of Amazon.com. And don't forget, it's kind of a worldwide venture that's going on right now. My UK sales are also very good in the ebook at the moment.
Which personality is going to survive this? Is it going to be Audrey, the genre writer, or Deborah, the literary novelist?
Long term, I will just carry on both tracks.
Have you set aside in your household budget any money for therapy sessions to deal with your nascent case of multiple personality disorder?
I actually think that Audrey Braun has released Deborah Reed from a lot of her neurosis. She sort of has this no-nonsense, get-over-yourself attitude. She will sit down and she will get the work done, and she doesn't self-edit. She's not insecure or self-critical. She just writes, and she just has a ball.
Deborah, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Deborah Reed is the author of Carry Yourself Back to Me. She is also the author, as Audrey Braun, of A Small Fortune. No question, ebooks are transforming the industry, not just because we no longer think of books strictly as physical objects, but because we may start thinking of them as advertising platforms. It might sound blasphemous, turning books into tiny billboards, but there are some advantages for the advertised, too. Brian Altunian is CEO and chairman of Wowio, which works with publishers to distribute ebooks with ads. The ads really push down the cost of the book to the consumer. In fact, sometimes those books cost the consumer nothing. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob. Great to be here.
There is a quid pro quo that I guess we've all grown used to about accepting ads as the price of getting free or subsidized content, but I don't know that it extends to books. It feels just somehow, icky.
I wouldn't want to be in the middle of a chapter of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and have an ad pop up intrusively. However, I do think if done appropriately and done subtly and done in a way that does make aesthetic sense and doesn't interrupt the flow of the reading experience, I think the trade-off of having access to a broad selection of content is worth having an advertisement component.
The ads that you're using show up in the beginning of the book before you get to the actual text, right?
And we personalize it. You know, an advertiser will have a chance to say, this book is sponsored for Brian Altunian, courtesy of Wells Fargo. And a second page, which actually gives Wells Fargo the opportunity to offer some sort of promotion, that if I click on that, I'm taken out to a landing page that Wells Fargo has created that tells me their promotional deal of the day or deal of the month or deal of the quarter.
I happen to be looking at a Wowio version of Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. The first page is an ad for DirecTV. As I go into the text, it is not interrupted, but I'm a little skeptical that I'm not eventually going to see that. Can I be really sure that this is not going to go to some, you should excuse the expression, ad absurdum?
It's very likely that could happen. I would say we at Wowio don't intend to do that. But I think that what will happen then is a consumer will be given the choice of either have the book be subsidized and include ads or have it be fee-based with no ads.
So I got to tell you, I bristled when I first saw the cover of the Slaughterhouse-Five book and saw the ad from DirecTV, because it says, it is a gift to me from DirecTV. And I'm like, it's not a gift. They're trying to reach prospective DirecTV customers, which, raises the question, DirecTV, it's a satellite, service, the equivalent to your local cable TV system. You would think the last place that they were trying to find customers was from people who read books.
Well, it's interesting because if you think, you know, DirecTV, as you say, as a service that has 3,000 channels now, you know, the selection of content is pretty broad. And so if they're sponsoring books in the history category and it helps to promote the history channel, then there is a relationship. And the advantage that the digital distribution platform provides is a granularity, you know, an opportunity to be seen by the consumer that will eventually become a consumer of their product.
It strikes me that if Wowio works, the business model is going to be immediately embraced by the big e-book distributors of the world, like, let's say, Amazon, and that you were going to just be rendered irrelevant almost overnight.
Amazon had about a 95% market share of the e-book space until about a year and a half ago. It's now about 55%. So that shows you that there's definitely opportunity for companies such as Wowio. A broadened base of books creates a voracious appetite for reading. That's just going to increase the demand for e-books, traditional books, books of all kinds.
Brian, thank you very much.
Bob, thank you.
Brian Altunian is CEO and chairman of Wowio.
Coming up, a San Francisco transit cop explains why his agency cut off cell phone service and one of history's least popular radio hosts.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
Support for this On the Media podcast comes from Audible.com, provider of digital audiobooks and more, with more than 85,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. Audible suggests that On the Media listeners might enjoy I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee 59, Ben Mesrick's Sex on the Moon, or John Hart's Iron House. To learn more about Audible and get a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/onthemedia.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Given social media's role in mobilizing against tyrants, especially in the Arab world, we are quick to call foul when an authoritarian regime blocks access. But what about when a democracy does it? When rioters in the UK, allegedly aided by BlackBerry Messenger, began looting early this month, Prime Minister David Cameron suggested that the government should be able to turn off social media used to abet crime. Recently in suburban Washington and Philadelphia, flash mobs have popped up, and many blame social media for helping them coordinate crime. And just last week, San Francisco's Bay Area Rapid Transit, or BART, cut off cell phone service in some stations to forestall communication among protesters. Suddenly, BART was being compared to repressive Middle Eastern governments. Obviously, trying to protect commuters is a world apart from trying to quash speech. But it still raises the question, at what point, if any, is it okay for authorities to control emerging channels of communication? Of course, BART doesn't shut down cell service every time it faces protests. It's only happened once. And in fact, just this week, there was another protest at a BART station, and authorities did not disconnect cell phone service. BART Deputy Police Chief Daniel Hartwig says his department is learning to use social media.
Our police department, as in many police departments, rely upon the same social media that these protesters utilize, and we recovered information based upon those sites that described their communication process.
Obviously, there is maintaining the public safety and order, and then there is suppressing political protest and freedom of speech. Can the police department be trusted to make the decision when it is the former and not the latter?
We never lead with suppression of social media, suppression of First Amendment rights, suppression in any manner. Recently, these demonstrations have moved from street level in an open public forum area where public demonstration and protest is accepted and encouraged. Once it moves down into the subway station, it is not a safe and a secure location to have a large number of people gather and attempt to obstruct public transportation. We have to do everything within our power to ensure the safety and security at that specific location.
At one point in this series of protests, you shut down the service, and then for a subsequent demonstration or planned demonstration, you left service intact. Why?
When the first shutdown of the social media occurred, there was specific information that we received that led us to believe that that was a key tool to their activities. I don't believe this Monday that was part of the scenario.
Your episode happened in the middle of violence in London, an apparent gang flash mobs in Philadelphia, and so on. To what extent did the experience of law enforcement in those cities inform the decisions you made in San Francisco?
I think when these ideas are vetted between different departments, not just the police department, but other departments we rely upon, I am sure that those are taken into consideration. That being said, what I'm focused on is what is evolving in front of me. I'm not taking inventory on what is occurring outside of the BART system in some other nation or some other city.
Inevitably, when tyrants suppress political speech, they do so under the pretext of protecting the citizens. And so, essentially, the message that you're giving me is what the Mubaraks of the world are saying to their people to rationalize the use of force. It seems to me that in the debate about what BART did to protect its riders, people have invoked these very rationalizations. How do you process that?
I've heard the comparisons about tyrants, about how they defend their actions. All rely upon our safety record. At this point in time, we haven't had anybody hurt. We've had very few arrests. I don't know how to make it any clearer. Suppression of First Amendment rights, suppression of social media is not what we lead with. Walk into the BART system when you're in the Bay Area, and part of the equipment that you'll see is social media, some form, iPhone, BlackBerry, whatever. When you remove it, for whatever reason, it's not a comfortable feeling. We do not enter into this lightly. We've done it one time. Will we do it again? I don't know. Will it remain in our toolbox? I imagine, yes, it will.
Daniel Hartwig is Deputy Chief of the Bay Area Rapid Transit Police Department. Jillian York is Director for International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Jillian, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
So Chief Hartwig just explained to us why shutting down social media was a tactical decision for the purpose of protecting the riders. EFF takes a very different view. Why?
I recognize that there are limits to free expression. Incitement to violence is a major one. However, I don't believe that we should exercise prior restraint on things like this. Preemptively striking on expression is the problem here.
The reason we're having this conversation isn't only because of the BART incident. It happens that the BART episode occurred in the midst of a lot of other violent and disruptive activity in various places around the world. The riots in London, flash mobs formed in suburban Washington, D.C. and suburban Philadelphia, where, you know, a bunch of hoodlums got together using social media with the specific purpose of creating havoc, you know, clearing out a 7-Eleven of much of its merchandise, for example. So clearly, the tools that social media provide are being abused.
Yes, at the same time that social media can be a tool for good, it can also be a tool for bad. While all of this was happening, while the riots were happening in the UK and the BART protest and the incident that you mentioned in Philadelphia, Syrians were using social media to upload videos of atrocities committed by their government. 2011, we've seen the absolute incredible power of social media to be a force for good. Now we're seeing the flip side of that.
The question is, if people do in fact use social media to coalesce flash mobs or other violent activity, what is a benevolent government to do?
A better solution to a lot of this is to monitor and pursue those who are actually committing a crime. Twitter's a public forum, so all of these tweets are going out to the world, and the police can see them, I can see them. Say the UK had shut down access to Twitter, and then where does that speech go? It probably pushes that private. And so then you have these private conversations happening to organize the same exact thing that was happening on Twitter. And so what we have there is a situation where it's harder for the police to get to it.
I want to ask you about the rhetoric of the debate, the sort of casual comparisons of the actions of the Bay Area Rapid Transit Police to Mubarak. Does it help when police trying to do their best are compared to tyrants?
I do think that these are two different situations, but at the same time, the actions of the BART police did very much reflect the actions of Mubarak earlier this year in shutting down this media. And then actually on Twitter, we've seen a lot of Egyptians using the hashtag Mubartek as a joke and offering their support to the protesters in San Francisco. While these things did happen on very different scales, the intent was the same, to shut down speech in light of protests. We are looking at this as precedent, as a slippery slope, and I do fear that this is something we're going to be seeing a lot more often.
Prime Minister David Cameron has talked about shutting off social media, clearly not to suppress political speech, but to just stop rioters from looting.
Well, so no, that's true. I mean, as far as I can tell, it is rioting and not political speech. But at the same time, you know, now China is saying, oh, well, you know, if the UK can do it, what's wrong with us doing it? And the second a democratic society shuts down cell phone service, it's giving a pass to any other society that wants to do it.
All right, Jillian, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jillian York is Director for International Freedom of Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Years ago this summer, a woman named Mildred Gillers was released from prison. Gillers was one of the only American women ever to be convicted of the crime of treason. Many of the people who knew her late in life, years she spent quietly in Ohio, had no idea of her past. They didn't know that between 1942 and 1945, Gillers was better known to the world as Axis Sally, a Berlin-based radio host on German state radio broadcasting pro-Nazi propaganda.
And the enemies are precisely those people who are fighting against Germany today, and in case you don't know it, indirectly against America too. Because a defeat for Germany would mean a defeat for America, believe me.
Historian Richard Lucas has written a biography of Gillers called Axis Sally, the American Voice of Nazi Germany.
Her broadcasts were basically two-pronged. One, to American women at home, and also her broadcasts were aimed at the American soldiers fighting on the front lines.
And the messages for the people on the front lines?
We know where you are. We know you're coming and you're going to be destroyed. The other messages included, your girlfriends, your wives are home with the four Fs, the slackers, and are being romanced by them.
Frequently in her broadcasts to the Americans at home, she's exhorting them to use a kind of tough love to defy the country.
If your child behaves badly, do you agree with its misbehavior? Do you say to yourself, my child, right or wrong, I don't care what he does? No, you don't. You try to correct that child. You try to make him a better citizen. Well, do you say, my country, right or wrong? No, girl. That's false sentimentality. And I do not say my country right or wrong. I love America, but I do not love Roosevelt and all of his kite boyfriends who have thrown us into this awful turmoil.
She would broadcast the names and injuries or deaths of soldiers. She would say to their mothers or wives, that's what you get for supporting the war.
Yes, and I have some examples of that here.
Mm-hmm.
How many very mutilated boys have I seen? And they've said to me, I don't care how I get back, just so I get back. You see, that's the way they think now. What do you suppose they'll think in later years when there are no jobs for cripples? And it goes on. She tells a mother whose wounded son is in a German hospital, well, Mrs. Leupold, you've seen nothing of this war. You only read Jewish propaganda in your newspaper, but if you've been listening to this broadcast, then you know that for many weeks I went from war hospital to war hospital, and I saw your boys. There are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them, scattered all over the world, asked to sacrifice their youth, asked to sacrifice their future. Because when they get back, they will be in no state to take up a job of any consequence.
Okay, who was Mildred Gillers? I know she had a lousy childhood.
She did have a terrible childhood. She lost her biological father at the age of 7. Her stepfather was an itinerant dentist who became addicted to alcohol and the laughing gas in his practice. And I also found that she perhaps was abused as the stepdaughter, sexually abused. She could not wait to get away from the stepfather, and she went to Ohio Wesleyan University and came under the influence of a man who told her that she should pursue acting. And she went to Cleveland with $20 in her pocket, and she became an actress. And then within a year, she went to Broadway. And she was in George White's Scandals, the vaudeville show.
So things were going pretty well.
On and off, yes. But she had this innate ability to mess up a good situation. She always wanted to do Shakespeare and Ibsen. If it was comedic material, she didn't want to remain there. And at that point, 1929, 1930, when the Great Depression took hold and vaudeville was dying, it all fell apart. She became involved with a man, British and Jewish, and he was a foreign officer for Britain. He was assigned to Algiers, and she followed him to Algiers. And after that relationship fell apart, she went to Europe, met her mother, and they ended up in Berlin, 1934. And that's where she sees the Third Reich in its infancy, sees the enthusiasm, sees the employment opportunities, and she decides to stay.
She later said that she feared poverty in the U.S., and she wanted a German man that she'd been dating to marry her.
Yes. In 1941, she was counseled by the U.S. consulate to return back to the United States. She had just started working for the Nazi radio, and she was involved with a man named Paul Erickson. He was a German citizen. And he told her, if you return to the United States, I will never marry you. She was already 40 years old at the time. She decided to remain. And then when Pearl Harbor occurred, she was in a position where she could not go back. Paul Erickson, the fiancé who was going to marry her, was sent to the Eastern Front and killed.
And that was that. And she was stuck.
Yes. And then Max Otto Koischwitz, a former Hunter College professor, who fled back to Germany with his entire family in 1939, right before the outbreak of World War II, became her manager. They had an illicit affair. He was married with 3 daughters and 1 on the way. He wrote her scripts, directed her propaganda, encouraged her, even telling her that Shakespeare was propaganda.
When she finally went on trial, did her prosecutors present evidence of her impact?
One by one, prisoners of war and families of prisoners of war had come out to say that their families had heard the broadcasts. There were witnesses from Germany who were called to testify that they were eyewitnesses to her treachery. In the court, the judge and prior court cases had said it didn't matter whether anyone at all had heard her broadcast. It didn't matter if she said it on a microphone and no one heard it at all. She's still liable for treason.
And she apparently gave the performance of her life during her trial.
She did. And when the prosecution played a recording of her saying, American mothers, did you raise your sons to be murderers? She collapsed in the court.
You think she really fainted?
No. She had a habit of swooning when it got a little tight.
How'd you feel about her at the end of this project?
Conflicted. You can see in her time in prison how she changed.
How many years in prison?
12.
And what was the change?
She was a racist and anti-Semite. When she came in, didn't want anything to do with the other women. She was totally unrepentant. She was actually put in Alderson Prison in West Virginia, where Martha Stewart served her term. And she changed over that time. She converted to Roman Catholicism. She started to teach the other women in the prison. She ran the choir for the Protestants and the Catholics. And I really believe that she had a true conversion. By the same token, she still denied knowing anything about the Holocaust to the day she died.
On the day she was found guilty, she said to reporters, "I wish those who judge me would be willing to risk their lives for America the way that I did." Did she vary from that position?
No, she never varied from that position.
So let me ask you, Richard, why are you conflicted?
I'm conflicted because I believe that there is redemption, and I believe she had some measure of it. I believe that she changed remarkably in her later years. When you spend the first two-thirds of your life seeking nothing but fame and spend the last third seeking nothing but obscurity and privacy, I think you've changed, and changed in a major, major way.
Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Richard Lucas is a historian and author of Axis Sally, the American voice of Nazi Germany.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Emily Chin and Joe Rosenberg, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.